There is, we know, a kind of power in stories. So we use them as an educative tool, specifically in contexts where we're tutoring or teaching or even homilizing. And stories have a way, a capacity to communicate a sense of self, to communicate community, relationships, and even to communicate culture. We use stories when we sit around and regale our friends. With them, we create bonds of solidarity. With them, we encourage mutual understanding. But might stories, and specifically literature, also serve as philosophy? So in what follows, I propose to address three concerns or three questions. First, what is philosophy? Second, what is literature, or what purpose does it serve? And third, how can literature function in the task of philosophizing, and whether or not it can do so fruitfully? So first, what is philosophy? I suppose to even ask the question sounds a little bit dramatic, but we can begin with the etymology. So it's phileo, I love, sophia, wisdom. So philosophy is generally acknowledged as a kind of love of wisdom. And as it's been practiced in the tradition, dating back to Thales and the pre-Socratics, so at least for the last 2,600 years, is as a kind of deliberate pursuit of the causes of the things at stake, the causes of reality, so that we can grasp something of their very natures. So the first questions that animated the pre-Socratics, like Thales and Anaximenes and Anaximander et alia, was what is the stuff out of which the world is constituted? And specifically, how do I account for continuity and for change? And so it wasn't sufficient to just do science in the way we kind of understand it as empirical science. You had to ask deeper, more thoroughgoing questions of the things at hand. And so the philosopher, we acknowledge as one perhaps a bit abstracted, perhaps a bit aloof, perhaps a bit absent-minded, but one who is animated by the question of what is. What are the things at hand? What makes a thing to be what it is? Now, I would put to you that the characteristic virtue of the philosopher is wisdom. The characteristic virtue of the philosopher is wisdom. Now, what is a virtue? Quite simply, virtue is a good habit. So we recognize the fact that we are made on the way and not yet there. So when we are born, we are not born with full competence over our powers of thought or of choice, but rather we need to be, educated into the use of them. We need to be disciplined. We need to train up in our own humanity. And so in order to do that, we have to acquire virtues, good habits of mind and heart and passion, so that we can actually choose what is right. First, see it as such, and then second, prosecute it accordingly. So a virtue is simply those stable habits of mind and heart which permit me to act easily, promptly, and joyfully for what is good, what actually represents my good. And among the virtues, of which there are many, we identify certain intellectual virtues, so named because they inform our mind. They permit for us, or they enable us, to think or write more consistently. And in the kind of classic enunciation, there are five. So it's wisdom, knowledge, understanding, prudence, and art. Each has its own respective competence, but the one that concerns us now is wisdom. And the way that wisdom is often described is quite beautiful, I think. So to be wise is to be able to see the conclusions in the principles and the principles in the conclusions. So recall that in the kind of ancient tradition, it was characteristic to philosophize in syllogisms. The one that we always hear is that all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. So you have premises from which you deduce conclusions. But the one who is wise kind of sees what is entailed in premises as by a kind of intuitive burst. So just like, you know, in your geometry class, at a certain point, you recognized a theorem as true. You didn't need it proved, but you could simply recognize it as true. Like, you know, in an ABC triangle, the exterior angle to, you know, angle A is just the sum of angles B and C. You can kind of memorize that, and then all of a sudden it translates for you. You're like, oh, the interior angles are 180 degrees. This is a straight line, you know, subsected by this particular segment, as a result of which, but it just dawns upon you in a kind of intuitive grasp. So you see what formerly you deduced. And so the wise man is one who is able to see the premises in the conclusions, and the conclusions in the premises. He can kind of see how reality hangs together, or how it hinges. That was seen as a classic kind of vocation of the philosopher, was to address the hinges of reality. It's like when you carve a turkey. If you know where the joints are, it's simple. If you don't, it's butchery in the negative sense, right? Now, wisdom can also be seen as a kind of sharing in providence. A kind of sharing in providence. So in the deistic understanding, there is a God who creates and orders. A God who creates and orders. And he has a notion as to how he orchestrates all of these things in the contingent reality of our lives to return to him. So it's not that he's tinkering, or it's not that he is overly involved in a kind of way that militates against our freedom, but rather he is moving strongly and sweetly to draw all to himself. But there's this sense of unity, a unity of a purpose which includes all secondary causes, all instrumental causes, all agents like us. And so the philosopher develops a kind of sympathy, a kind of sensitivity to providence. He can actually see how the things of this world are orchestrated, how they hang together, and how they fit. So, perhaps in shorthand, we can say that it's true of the philosopher that he is able to look at his life and to know why. He's able to look at his life and to know why. Or to borrow something from a movie that came out about 10, 15 years ago, he's able to call each thing by its right name. He's able to call each thing by its right name. I don't know if you've ever been tortured by the experience of trying to find the right word, what the French call the mot juste, to try to find the right word to describe precisely the experience that you're having, but it eludes you, it evades you, and so you stumble over things. It's like, it was sneaky, but not in a bad way. It was like surreptitious, but not clandestine, and I just can't come up with the exact word. So the philosopher is one who is maddened by that desire, but really to name all of reality. And it's something that captivates him for the entirety of a life. Now, that's just a kind of thumbnail sketch of the task, the vocation of a philosopher. But there are certain difficulties for a philosopher. And here is where we're going to find a fruitful interchange with literature. So we're going to address two difficulties on the side of the subject, the thinking subject, and then one difficulty on the side of the object. Okay? So we'll just keep these in mind, and then we'll address them more concretely as we go forward. So first, difficulty on the side of the subject. There are just limitations to being embodied. Limitations of being embodied spirits. So, for instance, time. We live in the movement of time. Heraclitus, one of these pre-Socratic philosophers, who antedates, you know, the Common Era by like 5 centuries, he says you can never step in the same river twice. You can never step in the same river twice. He has this kind of notion that everything is flux. All is passing. And we experience something of that acutely in our own lives. Everything is passing. Everything is, in a certain sense, fading away. You're all dying. Kind of. In a certain sense. Okay. So we also experience this limitation in terms of place. Right? So because I am here, I am not elsewhere. And because I am here, also you aren't here. People experience that very acutely in relationships. People want to be close. They want to be united. They want to kind of, I don't know, share the same atmosphere. But they always come up against the obstacle that I am me and you are not. And as a result of which, you cannot be here in the same way that I am. So like chaste lovers try to overcome by giving of themselves, and less than chaste lovers by devouring the other. We also experience this limitation in terms of succession or discovery. So we are discursive beings. So like that syllogism that I outlined is true, it's constitutive for our thought. We discover progressively. We may have intuitive bursts, but we are on the way. And we are always discovering ourselves in dialogue with the reality that we experience. But we're never wholly in possession of our identity until such time as it is given to us entirely. So that's our first limitation on the side of the thinking subject, the first difficulty for the philosopher, namely that I am limited by virtue of the fact that I am an embodied spirit. Second, we are also liable to error in self-evaluation. Okay? So we can be deceived about ourselves. We all know this. We don't like to admit it, but I think we all know it. right? So we don't have immediate access to our interior states. We kind of discover ourselves in acting. In agency, we see the kind of people that we are and become either more so or less so. So my classic example for this is the my bad guy, okay? I don't know if you've ever played pickup sports. This is especially acute in basketball. But there's always a guy on the court that every time he makes a mistake, he goes, my bad, my bad. But he just does it again and again and again and again. You know, like he's 5'7", he's got like a, you know, like a 14-inch vertical, and he keeps trying to do like up and unders. You know, he keeps trying to do like chase down blocks. He keeps trying to like cross people up in the middle of the court. He's got no handles. And at a certain point, you're like, it's worse than just being your bad. You are bad. Like, you're not a good basketball player. And the sooner you acknowledge that, the sooner you will cease being a scourge to everyone you play with. But we like protect ourselves from the recognition that we're just not that good at stuff, because it's better not to think about it than to address the fact that I'm not that good at stuff. Right? Heartbreaking, but true, okay? So that's the second limitation on the side of the thinking subject. We are liable to error. We are liable to self-deception. And then the third and final limitation is on the side of the object. The fact that just things are opaque. Things are hard to get at. Things are hard to access. This is especially true with other people. I don't know if you've ever had a slight misunderstanding that absolutely befuddled you. It's like, dude, how did that upset that person? That defies me. Like, I was very sensitive and solicitous for their good, and now they're just like walking off in a towering rage. How will I ever amount to anything in life? You know, it's just like, it's supremely dispiriting to encounter that. But like, on a more base level, it's hard just to know anything out there. We only have limited access. So St. Thomas Aquinas famously said that we cannot exhaust the essence of a fly. You can never know everything of what it is to be a fly. Sure, we can describe a bundle of properties that identify a fly, but to know really what's at the heart of flyness, that's still a bit beyond us, right? Okay, so that's our first point of three, just to describe philosophy and then to identify some difficulties for philosophy and the philosopher. The second thing is to give a kind of explanation of how I see literature functioning in the human community. So literature is a speech act. Literature is a speech act. It uses language for the purpose of communication. Speech acts are for communication. And now this is a contentious supposition, but I would put it to you that communication is for truth-telling. Okay. Communication is for truth-telling. Otherwise, communication breaks down. If you live in a society in which there is not even honor among thieves, you can't even muster the courage to leave your home, because you could be deceived at every turn. Because if the man programming the streetlights is not on the same page regarding truth-telling, then you don't know that you're just going to get T-boned as you cross between, whatever, the streets that are just right out your door. So communication, I'm saying, is premised on truth-telling. And so literature is literature to the extent and degree that it is truth-telling. Now you might say, Father Gregory, aren't you being a little bit fundamentalistic about this? Aren't there plenty of literary genres, some of which entail deception? Yes, you've anticipated my next point. Thank you. So there are plenty of genres, and it's significant that we refer to literature as pertaining to the genre of what? Fiction, which is shorthand for falsity. But I put it to you that it deceives so as to reveal. All of the fictionality is for the purpose of communicating a deeper truth. And you can see this in genres. So historical fiction, you fictionalize certain aspects so as to tell a more compelling narrative to draw people into the history described. Or like magical realism, if you've ever read any of the short stories of Borges. You change one thing about reality, you tinker with one dimension, and then you play it out, so that you can appreciate how deeply interdependent all of reality is. Or fantasy. Fantasy is for revealing the heights and depths of human aspirations by giving them a cosmic sphere in which to play out. So all of them are essentially about truth-telling. All of them are engaged in a speech act of truth-telling. So I would put to you that all other considerations in literature are secondary. So advocacy, for instance, is secondary. It may be a worthy goal, but it has to be a secondary goal, or it will pervert the nature of the literature described. So it's first about the truth, and then second about what may follow. So too, moral reform. Moral reform is a secondary consideration. If moral reform is the sole purpose or the arbiter of your literary genre, then it will pervert the narrative, it will pervert the characters, it may even pervert the drama. We can tease this out in the question and answers, but that's just what I'm proposing. So, passing now from the nature of literature as a speech act, what is it that animates the author? Why do they engage in this speech act? Here, I would put it to you that literature has a kind of parallel, you know, function, as do the visual arts, and that they exist for the purpose of a kind of revelation, to show to you what you had not previously acknowledged. So I'm from southeastern Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia, and I never thought that my region was especially beautiful. I just never recognized it as such. I just thought it was home. It was the place where my house was and where my family lived, and I never compared it to anything else because I didn't have a wide experience. And it was actually, I went to the National Gallery, and they had an exhibit of Andrew Wythe. Andrew Wythe was from Brandywine, Pennsylvania, which is like Chester County or Delaware County, but right around Philadelphia. And then he vacationed in Maine, at a place where I too have family. And so I was looking at these two regions that I had lived in and spent a lot of time in, but through the artist's eyes. And all of a sudden, I was just captivated and spellbound because I saw what I had always seen, but through an artist's gaze, in such a way that transfigured it and gave it to me as if for the first time. And so when I went back to Philadelphia, not only was I more deeply appreciative, but I also like went to where he grew up. I went to Brandywine. I saw his studio. I saw the museum. I saw all these different paintings and watercolors and whatever the one is, egg tempura. It was just super beautiful, and it changed the way that I interact with my region. So I would put to you that literature serves a similar purpose. It's supposed to transfigure reality and give it back to you in a new way. And I would say specifically with respect to that central feature of the reality as we experience it, namely ourselves. Ourselves in relation with God, with each other's, with the polity, with the things that matter. So it's meant to give you back your humanity in a way that's been revealed. So the task of an author is first to create a world with characters. It is to create something real and true. And the drama ensues. Many authors testify to the fact that they make characters and then they kind of see what happens. Right? Like J.K. Rowling admitted at the end of the seventh book of Harry Potter that Harry should have married Hermione. She's like, yeah, I don't know what got into me. Like the characters were clearly tending in that direction, but I just lost the nerve. So she acknowledged the fact that her characters had a kind of life of their own because she had made them real. Real in a way that made something like, I don't know, 35 million Americans pick up books for the first time in forever. Pretty cool. Okay. So the task is first to create a world in which real people live. And this is why I think you can see, okay, I don't know, has anyone ever seen a Wes Anderson movie? It'd be like Fantastic Mr. Fox, Isle of Dogs, okay. I like them very much. And he's meticulous about many things in the making of movies. But it's fascinating that the one thing he's not meticulous about is people. They are filled with stilted conversations. He can make a set that is incredible. He can set, like, Bill Murray up for some of the most devastating one-liners in all of cinematographic history. But he just can't actually communicate human loves, or he really struggles to. But I think that that is to put the cart before the horse. I think that that is primarily what an artist ought to be interested in, which is, I think, why a lot of people walk away from Wes Anderson movies, like, amused but vexed. Okay. So, in this sense, in the sense that I've described, the artist is provident. Provident in the way that we described God as orchestrating the things that play out in reality. And so the artist participates God's creation in a way that makes him wise. So he is first a contemplative. He observes what is, that shapes him, and then he becomes a kind of provident agent in the shaping thereof. So he can help you to recognize a common humanity in the characters, and in so doing, he reveals at once our grandeur and our degeneracy, our power and our vulnerability. He's able to capture it all and to communicate it. So, it's for this reason that sometimes literature is painful to read, because it reveals things to us about ourselves which we would prefer not to acknowledge. Has anyone ever read Kristen Lovren's Daughter by Sigrid Undset? Okay, I've got one tremulous hand. So it's a long book. It's like 1,100 pages, and it's basically about how an individual makes dubious moral decisions, very slight at first and then more pronounced, and then their life is destroyed. It's 1,100 pages of character suicide. It's incredible, beautiful, fascinating. And on the one hand, you feel like you feel when you're about to see a car crash. Like, you know, it's like you would that it were not, and you almost go to try to stop her. Like, oh, Kristen, stop it. You know, the bad guy is around the corner. But that's not the point. That's to miss the point of literature. Because what the author is doing, Undset in this case, is playing out a human world in which real people are living, and you're able to see yourself in them, and the tragedy that you experience touches your own humanity. You recognize in yourself a similar fragility. You recognize that so too could you go, were it not for the choice of your parents, or the choice of your school, or happenstance, chance, fortune, whatever. Okay? So, first, that's philosophy. Second, that's literature. And then third and finally, just a little kind of pastiche of literature as philosophy. So I submit to you, for the reasons described, that good literature can promote the growth of philosophic virtues in the reader. So I'm not saying that literature is philosophy in the strict sense. And here we want to be deliberate about that. It's not. It's a decidedly different thing. So philosophy abstracts from reality, right? When you do natural philosophy, you're abstracting from concrete particulars. When you do math, you're abstracting from basically everything except for figure and number. That's all that you're really working with. When you do metaphysics, you're abstracting from everything except for like being. So you're talking about it in its most abstract sense. You've really moved away from particulars. Sometimes you engage with them, but often you're thinking about being and truth and goodness. So you're thinking about things that are more so conceptual than concrete. Now, literature is revelatory precisely in the concrete, embodied, and particular. So it has a very different trajectory. It directs your gaze awesomely and adamantly to this thing, so that therein you might encounter something of the real. So, but I put to you that literature can beget philosophic wonder and wisdom, and it can cultivate in an individual the capacity to look at your life and to know why, to call each thing by its right name, which is our working definition of what wisdom is. So now, let's recall the difficulties for philosophy, and then I'm going to summarize how they are addressed in literature. So first, we said that on the side of the subject, there are limitations to just being embodied, to being an embodied spirit. Second, that we're subject to error in self-evaluation. And then third, on the side of the object, that matter can be opaque to us. It eludes us. It evades us. It's difficult for us to grasp and describe. Now, there are three features of literature that help us to overcome these problems attendant upon the discipline of philosophy. So I would say to you that it's proper to literature to kind of telescope time and place so as to establish a tight narrative continuity. I'm going to revisit all these points, all right? So it telescopes time and space. It brings you down to a manageable unit of time and space, so that way you can have narrative continuity. You can actually understand the characters in the whole sweep of the narrative. Because otherwise, it's very easy to lose sense of oneself as a narrative being. Also, literature engages with this unit as a whole thing, okay? So literature always gives you a whole something. So it's not partial, it's not fragmentary. Mind you, it may be only a limited section of a person's life, but it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Or it ought to, unless you're reading Hemingway, and then you just gave up on ends because he thought they were trite. So literature gives you a unit, and it's to be interpreted as a whole, okay? So this is just the first thing that I'm going to describe. This is with respect to the limitations of human flesh. So we're saying that the difficulty for philosophy is that we experience limitations of human flesh, and the way that literature addresses it is that it telescopes time and space to establish a tight narrative continuity, and that it purports to be whole. It's a whole unit, okay? Now, to illustrate this, I'm going to take three stories from a 20th century Catholic author named Flannery O'Connor. So raise your hand if you've read any Flannery O'Connor. That's great. Thank you. So Flannery O'Connor lived, she was born in the 1910s or 20s, and I think she died in 1968 or thereabouts. She lived till she was about 45, pardon my scarcity on details. She went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. She, you know, trained in the writing of short fiction. And then she went to New York for a time to work as a writer. And then she contracted lupus, which I guess is congenital or hereditary. And then she moved down to Milledgeville, Georgia with her mother. And as she was gradually debilitated by the disease, she was more and more confined to bed. But she has a lot to say about literature as a discipline, and she has a lot to say in her writing itself. So she's a master of the short story. And all of her short stories are in one volume. There may be 30, 35 of them in total. And they're really excellent. They're strange, but they're worth revisiting. So the first that I'll describe is called A Good Man is Hard to Find. I'm just going to give you a little plot summary so that we're all up to speed. And then I'll just kind of unpack certain elements. So a man from Georgia named Bailey takes his family on a vacation to Florida. So it's him, his wife, his two children, and then his mother, who throughout the course of the story is just called the grandmother. Now, the grandmother, from the very start, is an absolute nuisance. So she's upsetting plans, she is talking up a storm, and she keeps reminiscing about the past. She's not happy about their plans to go to Florida because she has just read of a murderer on the loose in Florida who is called, apparently, the Misfit. So at one point, she tells her grandchildren, a story about a mysterious house nearby that she remembers from childhood, or at least she thinks she does. The children want to go, and they convince their reluctant father. As they drive further off the beaten path, the grandmother realizes that the house is nowhere near there. In fact, it's in a different state, so she had misremembered. But the realization actually makes her kick her feet. And mind you, she had smuggled her cat into the car and had kind of kept it covered under a blanket. But then kicking her feet causes the cat to be startled. The cat runs up onto the dad, Bailey, who's driving the car, who then runs off the road and flips the car into a ditch. Oh, yeah. So the family waits for help, and soon the grandmother flags down a car. Three men emerge with guns, and she recognizes the leader as the Misfit, and then she says so. He informs her that it would have been better for them if she had not recognized him. So one by one, the men take Bailey, his wife, and the children off into the woods, and they kill them. The grandmother alone is left, and she begins pleading for her life. At one point in her growing confusion, she actually thinks that the Misfit is going to cry. And so she reaches out and touches his shoulder tenderly, saying, "Why, you're one of my babies. You're one of my own children." His reaction is to jump away as if a snake had bitten him, and he kills her with three shots through the heart. The Misfit takes a moment to clean his glasses and says that the grandmother would have been a good woman if there had been somebody to shoot her every minute of her life. Okay, so this is like a 15 to 18 page story, but the thing that's beautiful about it is that it makes it so you can grasp the whole of this person in one instant. So you can see the whole shape and trajectory of the grandmother's life. So in her dealings with her family, she is a royal pain, and quite literally, she is the cause of their destruction. And the author is really good at communicating that. And you can extrapolate from your experience with her. You can see that her life has been one vexatious death. I mean, it's just like, she is so unconscionably bad throughout the entire of the story. But what's fascinating is that this whole experience of her life is counterposed with her end. And so at the end, we are forced to reevaluate our judgment. Recall the ancient dictum, call no man happy until he dies. So too, call no man annoying until he dies. So the title of the story is taken from a comment that she herself had made. And during one of her griping sessions, she recalls that a good man is hard to find. She's lamenting how things have gone down the tubes, how people used to be better and kinder and more solicitous and etc. And she is lamenting this and kind of, she's at a distance from those whom she judges. It's very clear that she is exempt from the judgment that she renders. But what is ironic is that she herself is intolerable. She is absolutely intolerable. She's probably the most detestable of the characters in the book, perhaps even more than the Misfit. And yet, at the final moment, we discover that there is a kind of grandeur to her spirit. Her motherhood is expressed in marvelous fashion. Recall, the only way by which she is addressed in the story is as the grandmother. She's fruitful. She is maternal. She gives life. Her whole identity is bound up in that. And yet, through the passage of time and the experience of modernity, It's been somehow perverted or stolen from her. But at the end, she sees the misfit as her son, because he is someone's son and may as well be hers. And that recognition proves an occasion of grace both for her and for the misfit himself. And it's fascinating. The story ends with the misfit chastising one of his sidekicks, Bobby Lee, for making a comment, quote, "some fun." "Shut up, Bobby Lee," he retorts. "It's no real pleasure in life." I love it. By telescoping a human life, the author reveals at once the irony and majesty that would have been otherwise untold. Because most of us would have only have ever had a momentary glimpse of this woman. We would have met her at a rest stop. We would have seen her at the knitting club. If anyone here knits, yes. Okay. But we would never have had a sense of how it ended. But the fact of its ending changes the whole of the story, which is awesome. So, that's our first point. The second point, recall, the second difficulty for philosophy that we can be self-deceived. There is error in self-evaluation. The second point is that literature can help to heal error in self-evaluation. So we don't have intuitive self-knowledge. We don't have immediate access to our interior states. We only really come to an appreciation of who we are on the way. So it's significant that, like, in every act of choice, not only do you choose what to do, you choose who you are going to be in the future, which is awesome. There's a kind of splendor to that. But what we have to do is to constantly reevaluate and re-narrate the story of our own lives. We're constantly telling ourselves the story of our lives. When people would ask me, like, "What are you doing this afternoon?" you know, in casual conversation at the House of Studies, with the expectation that it's like, "I'm going to read this book or do this thing," I would always say, "Taking a good, hard look at myself and reassessing my goals in life." They're like, okay. So what we find in literature is that by identifying with a sympathetic protagonist, we can actually observe ourselves in motion and learn something of ourselves from a unique vantage. So we're able to do the work of self-discovery, but in the literature itself. Here, we'll advert to another Flannery O'Connor story. This one is called Greenleaf. This is my favorite of hers. Short recap. Mrs. May owns a farm on which she hires Mr. Greenleaf to work because her sons are not interested in farm work. Both her sons live at home and are unmarried. They are something of an embarrassment to her. One sells insurance, the other is a scholar and teacher at a university. Both Mrs. May and Mr. Greenleaf's wife, Mrs. Greenleaf, consider themselves Christians. Mrs. May, however, has a somewhat smug morality based upon outward success, while Mrs. Greenleaf secretly practices faith healing and recognizes herself as a sinner. When no one is nearby, Mrs. Greenleaf prays aloud that Jesus, quote, "stab her in the heart," implying that Mrs. May must change her sinful heart. The Greenleaf's twin sons are decorated World War II veterans who both own farms. Considered successful, they are married to French women whom they met during the war, and they each have three children. When a bull belonging to Mr. Greenleaf's boys escapes onto Mrs. May's property, she orders Mr. Greenleaf to shoot it. She drives Mr. Greenleaf to a pasture to shoot the bull, and while Mr. Greenleaf is chasing it, the bull escapes into the woods. After becoming impatient, Mrs. May honks the car horn, and the bull runs out of the woods, goring her in the heart, just as Mr. Greenleaf reappears. Okay. And it actually says in the last lines that she is seen to embrace the bull. It's a devastating passage. Okay. So the way the story unfolds, Mrs. May is actually portrayed as a sympathetic character. She is diligent and hardworking. Now, mind you, she's been cursed with lazy sons, but she's actually somewhat in the right when it comes to the dispute over the bull. So it's happened before. It actually damages her property. And she's tried to get them to build a sufficient fence, but they just won't for whatever reason. And so, yeah, she's angry and with cause. But what we discover in the course of the story, again, short, 15 to 18 pages, is that beneath her justifiable and righteous indignation, there is a kind of hard-heartedness, one that Mrs. Greenleaf has rightly identified. And what happens is that she no longer really has access to reality. She has made reality assume the shape of her own deception. She is telling herself a story to which no one else is privy. She is telling herself a story that is actually bereft of pertinent details. It's false. And as a result, it's a lie, it's a trap, and it spells only death. And so, O'Connor here, the author, uses a kind of narrative violence to communicate in spades what it is that this woman needs to hear. Now here, tangentially, Flannery O'Connor wrote some prose on what she deploys in her short stories, her own narrative techniques, and she has this to say. Quote, "When you can assume that your audience holds the same beliefs you do, you can relax a little and use more normal means of talking to it. But when you have to assume that it does not, then you have to make your vision apparent by shock. To the hard of hearing, you shout. And for the almost blind, you draw large and startling figures." Later on, in the same collection of essays, she writes this, "I have found that violence is strangely capable of returning my characters to reality and preparing them to accept their moments of grace. Their heads are so hard that almost nothing else will do the work. This idea that reality is something to which we must be returned at considerable cost is one which is seldom understood by the casual reader, but it is one which is implicit in the Christian view of the world." So, what we see here is that the protagonist is made to suffer a conversion which we ourselves must undergo. And we begin by identifying with her. A lot of people have read the story and said a lot of things regarding it. And with respect to this kind of Christian view of the world, they actually speak of the bull as Christ. It's common to interpret the bull as Christ. That rather than let her languish in the shadow of deception, Christ happens upon her at the last and brings her to her senses. Mind you, in violent fashion. But O'Connor's whole point is that grace is often communicated in somewhat violent terms. Not to say it's always in like death-dealing murder, but it's in a way that we would not ordinarily have envisioned or perhaps not even have chosen. But we have to prefer the truth to our own comfort. We have to prefer what is real to the kind of smug satisfaction that comes of telling ourselves a lie. Okay, so that's our second point. Recall that the difficulty was that we are liable to error and self-deception, and that our experience of narrative helps us in identifying with sympathetic protagonists to be shaken and to be returned to our senses. The third and final difficulty that I identified was that matter is opaque, that things are just hard to understand, specifically concrete things. And here, this is another place where literature helps us, because it uses the concrete, which is closest to our senses, which for us is most immediately appetible. That is to say, it's shiny, it's tasty, it's desirous, you know? It uses those things to reveal what is universally true. So, I would put to you that abstract philosophical truths only gradually take hold of mind and heart, right? We fashion for ourselves the life philosophy, but it just takes time. And so, like, if someone says something from the front of the room in a kind of doctrinaire and inapplicable way, we're like, interesting, maybe not. Or we use one of those stock words that mean everything and nothing. Interesting, noteworthy, and fascinating. Those are my go-tos when I don't want to compliment or detract. Noteworthy. So, the narrative recounting communicates the general notion in the particular by a kind of revelation. So it's immediate, it's intuitive, it's almost ecstatic. It brings us out of ourselves. So rather than being tripped up by the particularity of the material, as we can sometimes be in philosophy, the author uses it as a privileged means or a privileged place of encounter with the truth. Our third and final Flannery O'Connor story. It's called The Enduring Chill. The story involves a man named Asbury, who is a writer from New York, who returns home to his mother's farm in the South after being diagnosed with a serious illness. Think here of Flannery. He is out of money, unsuccessful, and believes that he is dying. His mother finds a local doctor who draws some of Asbury's blood to examine. In bed, Asbury thinks about various experiences, including one the prior year when he interacted with the farmhands, and in a kind of show of rebellion against his mother, he smoked with them in the dairy barn. We later discover that the whole batch of milk had to be thrown away. During that same summer, Asbury encourages the farmhands to break his mother's rules in another way. So to show off his transgressive freedom, he drinks some milk right out of the cow's udder. However, the farmhands refuse to drink as Asbury did. So he wants to have this kind of like strange solidarity with them where he's saying like, you know, forget the rules, let's do what feels right. But they don't come along with him, and in the case of the smoking, it proves disastrous for the product. Now, after some serious deathbed histrionics, he takes himself way too seriously. It's awesome. Asbury is informed by the doctor that he has undulant fever, probably from drinking raw milk. The illness will not kill him, but will continually recur and cause him pain. Now, philosophically, I could propose to you a distinction between freedoms. There is a kind of freedom of indifference and a kind of freedom for excellence. So on the one hand, we could use freedom as a way to protect ourselves from alien incursions of other minds, right? I am this unassailable and sovereign individual, and no one else can contribute to my acts of self-realization, right? And we could use, you know, just the mere fact that I can sin as a kind of show of the dignity of man, you know, to shout at the void for all eternity. That's the real grandeur of the human person. Or we could espouse a kind of notion of freedom for excellence, that freedom is poised particularly for the doing of the good, and that as I am more and more bound by the good, that I become freer to do what I love with excellence. Sure, LeBron James is free to, like, go out the night before games till 4 in the morning at, like, a club and make, like, dubious moral decisions. But he's bound by the fact of his basketball excellence, where that doesn't even represent a temptation for him. It's like, do I want to embarrass my opponents, or do I want to make this stupid choice that would leave me kind of like in the lurch? Like, clearly. So he has fewer choices, but he is bound by the good, and so he is freer to be excellent at it. He is freer to literally put an entire team on his back and take them from the bottom of the Western Conference to a contender, because he's the man, right? We're talking about LeBron James, right? So that's the kind of freedom that you're proposing. But if I were just to kind of put this in abstract philosophical terms, it's like, yeah, whatever, but how does that translate? But then you see it in Asbury. There's a kind of traditional wisdom. There's a kind of good proposed on the farm, but he chooses to deny it, or he chooses to shirk it, and as a result of which, it hurts him. You can actually see how the exercising of a malign freedom leads to the destruction of the person, and that the farmhands, who operate by a kind of folk wisdom, but a wisdom nonetheless, are actually more free to choose the good, even though they're not exercising this kind of transgressive nonsense. So, that is how the concrete particular shows something universally true, but precisely in and through it, not as an obstacle, but as a revelation, as a manifestation. So, in sum, literature is not philosophy, but when read in light of philosophical questions, it can complement the inquiry proper to philosophy. Essentially, both the philosopher and the author are after what is true. Both are engaged with the real, with life. And when taken together, they equip us well to call each thing by its right name. Thank you. If you have any questions, we have maybe 5 to 10 minutes. Yes, in the back.
So, given specifically your definition of the purpose of literature being communication of truth, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, I know one of the major concerns within the field is the appropriation and use of literature from different sources and traditions of thought, different cultures.
Sure.
What's common, coming at it, I'm a former high school teacher, and one of the concerns that they have is trying to educate specifically kids in the Catholic tradition, but then having the alternate concern of if you really only take sort of the main line on the literature side, if you really only take sort of the main line, these are works that are traditionally used to create a Catholic mindset, what you end up with, the criticism is you end up with a lot of old dead white guys.
Sure.
And so, being the purpose of literature is to communicate truth, can you talk about maybe the value or David pitfalls of trying to bring in other traditions into education in that kind of format?
Sure. So, I think reading literature that falls without one's normal compass can often be a difficult experience. So, like, for anyone who's contended with 19th century Russian literature, for some of us that's just far east enough as to be very mysterious. So I don't know if you've had these, like, reading The Idiot, and, you know, Prince Myshkin is at this party, which runs until, like, 2:30 in the morning, and everyone is uproariously joyful until about 1, and then at a certain point it takes a tragic turn, and everyone is weeping. It's like, what happened in the course of this party? You know, like, are Russians like this? So one summer I read The Idiot, The Brothers K, and Crime and Punishment, which was, it was a serious undertaking, and I think it was probably a bit misadventurous. But I had the distinct sense that I could not fully sympathize with the humanity lived in a Russian way, which for us is, so that's a good discipline, in as much as we have to recognize that human nature falls without our ordinary bounds of kind of like cultural imagination. So on the one hand, can we give pride of place to a certain tradition? Yeah, I think, like, especially, for instance, at like a Catholic school, like Providence College, they have a development of Western civilization program. Does that represent a kind of backward, like culturally obtuse valuation of things that, you know, like are not necessarily better? Like, no, it's Providence College is a Catholic school, and Catholicism is peculiarly, you know, grows up in Christendom, Western Europe, and the New World. So to read something as pertinent to your tradition is a good discipline, because in a certain sense, it's like a study of your identity. It's a kind of study of self-understanding. But should you be constrained exclusively to that? I don't think so. And here, I espouse the thought of one Alistair McIntyre, who's a virtue ethicist. He made virtue studies real big and popular, like 1981 when he wrote After Virtue. And he thinks that basically we can't undervalue the necessity to actually learn one thing well. So we actually have to occupy a tradition. So, like, for instance, Thomism takes about 10 years to learn. And you need to do that in order to think according to the paradigm. But it's not for the purpose of just hosting internecine debates. It's actually for the purpose of doing translation. Because you should be able to host dialogue in a way that's substantive. But in order to do that, you need to become a native speaker of a second language, which is arduous. Because we just said that Thomism, which is like most people would argue that is pretty easy as far as those things go. You get the lingo down, you get the terminology. Some call it jargon, I wouldn't. And then you just go, right? But that takes time. And so then to do the work of learning a second tradition, whether of contemporary analytic philosophy, or of neuroscience, or of some other particular competency that now has kind of purchase, is difficult, but it's necessary. Otherwise, we're always just going to be speaking out of the limited ambit of our own tradition with words that don't necessarily have the same meaning and valuation in another, and we risk talking past each other and then just kind of having it devolve into this shrill assertion and counter-assertion, provided that it's contentious, you know. Otherwise, it's irrelevant. So I think that one needs first be grounded in his own tradition, because evacuating that or abandoning that can sometimes be an exercise in futility, where you become a citizen of no country, which is a really perilous place to be, but that it has to be with a mind to actually communicating, because we believe it's possible. Why? Because in the Thomistic tradition, human nature is human nature, right? So we all share a common essence. We all share a common form. And so it's possible to translate amongst our insights. Now, some of those might be superly culturally conditioned. Superly isn't a word. Very culturally conditioned. And we're going to have to do the work of excavating what is meant when things are said. But it's possible. It's absolutely possible. Those are initial thoughts. Yes?
Is it possible to abstract philosophy from literature, or is that just not... Like, because we're talking about, like, what literature sort of can do for philosophers. Like, can you, like, get philosophy out of literature?
I think so. I think you can get philosophy out of art, especially if the artist is consciously philosophizing. So raise your hand if you've ever seen any of the films of Terrence Malick. Tree of Life, To the Wonder. He had a bunch in the 70s, and then he went dark for like 15 years. Most recent one was like Knight of Cups, which I don't think is watchable. Tree of Life is my favorite. So Terrence Malick studied Heidegger, and then he went into filmmaking. And so he does artistry almost consciously as a philosopher. So he's operating out of both virtues, namely, you know, wisdom and artistry. And I think in that sense, his artistry is suffused with a kind of philosophic gaze. And I think it is possible to abstract from that. You can also see this in, like, anyone ever read any David Foster Wallace? Right, so DF Dubs. So he is also very, very conscious of these things. I mean, he's super sensitive to, like, semiotics, for instance, and the nature of predication. And this all just, like, comes out in his valuation of modernity or his declaration of its bankruptcy. So I think with people who are philosophically sensitive, yes. I think it can sometimes do violence if you abstract a philosophy from an author, because sometimes they'll be really surprised at what you describe, because they're not operating out of that virtue. And so for them, it's a completely subsequent consideration that such, like, would arise. So, yeah. Okay. Thank you so much for your attention. Have a wonderful night.